Good morning, everybody. It's good to be with you. Today, what we're doing is we are kicking off our interlude series for 2025. It's called How Jesus Cares. If you're new to Revolution, an interlude series is a sermon series that we do here. It's one that we return to several times throughout a year, and we use them every year to create a through line for our teaching so that we can stay connected to our annual theme. This year, that theme is care. And also, we do this so that we can explore a given topic in a way that creates space over the course of the year for you to keep thinking about it. In the past, we've used interlude series to talk about the Psalms. We've used them to talk about the parables of Jesus, about the Apostles' Creed. And then last year, we talked about the Beatitudes. And this year, as we think about what it means to be cared for and caring people, we're going to look at individual stories of Jesus's care for others. Our hope, of course, is that we can learn from him. What does it mean to really care? How does Jesus care for different people differently? And of course, how can we learn to live and care more like him? Our first stop this morning is going to be one of the most thoroughly described interactions in Jesus' story, an encounter with a Samaritan woman at a well outside the town of Sychar. If you brought a Bible, you can find it in John chapter 4. We're also going to put the verses on the screen, and there's a lot to cover, so we're just going to kind of jump right in. We begin like this. Now Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that he was gaining and baptizing more disciples than John, although in fact it was not Jesus who baptized, but his disciples. So he left Judea and went back once more to Galilee. Now he had to go through Samaria. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there. And Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon. Our context here is that, at least in John's gospel account of this story, Jesus moves around a lot. I'm not going to exhaust the geography, but the basic point is that Jesus' home is in the north of Israel in a region called Galilee, and the capital and the temple of Israel are in the south in the region of Judea. When Jesus is in the north, he is in a more rural place among more rural people. Lots of shepherds, lots of fishermen, and lots of Gentiles or non-Jews. And these are all groups that you probably know Jesus seems to feel genuinely close to. And his ministry in these places tends to focus on teaching and meeting physical needs. But Galilee is a long way from the centers of Jewish power and faith and influence. So Jesus does, at various points in the Gospels, head south to Jerusalem. And there, he comes into more direct contact with the Pharisees, that's a name you probably remember, who are the reigning religious authorities at that moment. As well, he also comes as well into the contact with the political tensions between Jews and Romans. That's more common in the south. So when Jesus goes south in the Gospels, there's lots of Messiah talk. That word starts showing up all the time. His ministry is pulled by the crowds in Jerusalem towards something more overtly revolutionary. And then when he heads north, there's a lot of Son of Man talk. And his ministry tends to emphasize heart change and kind of grassroots cultural transformation. Anyway, between Galilee and Judea is a region called Samaria, which is populated by members of a distinct sect within Judaism, the Samaritans. And the main line of Judaism, so to speak, centers in Jerusalem, and it's followed the path of Jewish people who experienced an exile to Babylon in the 6th century BCE and then were returned. The Samaritan branch in the middle, however, is made up of Jewish people who were not exiled to Babylon and were instead allowed to stay. And for them, the center of worship is in a place called Mount Gerizim in Samaria, coincidentally. But for those who were exiled, the center is the temple. In Jesus' time, Samaritans were considered less than Galilean and Judean Jews, particularly by Galilean and Judean Jews, and communication between them was prohibited. Still, Jesus has to travel through there, and around noon, he gets thirsty. And so he goes to Jacob's well near the village of Sychar for water. Jacob, notably, is a common patriarch for both groups of Jews. So there's already some symbolic workings afoot here in the story. But we're going to move on. It says, a Samaritan woman came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, will you give me a drink? And his disciples had gone into town to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, you are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans. And Jesus answered her, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water. Sir, the woman said, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as also did his sons and his livestock? And Jesus answered, everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become in them a spring of water, welling up to eternal life. And the woman said to him, sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water. We talked already about the Judean-Samaritan tensions. So here's what I want us to see first, and it's also the title of this sermon. I want us to see the power of an unhurried conversation. It's always worth remembering, right, that the Gospels begin as an oral tradition. And when they are first written down, less than 10% of the population can even read. Writing itself is something that's expensive and requires professional tools and professional help. And so, not to be irreverent about this, but words are money. And for that reason, many of the stories in that oral tradition get pretty boiled down into the quickest possible ways to tell them. But not this one. This one isn't boiled down. Jesus does his thing. He more or less gets right down to business. He says, if you knew who you were talking to, you would ask for living water. But instead of cutting to the chase in the story where the woman is amazed and the woman converts, we get in this story banter. Banter. The woman pushes back on him, right? He says this and she just says, but you don't even have a bucket. She even digs in to the ethnic tensions between them, right? You heard it. She says, our father, Jacob, gave us this well. Now, why is all of this stuff here in the story? My thought, my guess, is it's here because we're supposed to wonder if we would have just walked away. This woman at the well is dropping pretty big hints to Jesus, right? I don't want to talk to you. This well, me, I am dry. And it matters in the story that Jesus doesn't give up on her. It matters that Jesus doesn't even rush her in the story. He listens to her, and then he even banters back. I don't know, he says. The water I've got is a living spring. It leads to life everlasting. She says, I'll take it. I hate walking to the well. What if we were better at banter? What if we did a better job of meeting people where they are? Jesus shows us that this doesn't have to mean avoiding big topics. He's still talking about actual salvation. But he doesn't let a serious subject get in the way of a less serious conversation. And he notably doesn't get his feelings hurt when this woman takes a few jabs at him. If we weren't so quick to either one, trade serious stuff for superficial stuff when we talk, or two, run away when things get prickly, where would our conversations go? Where could our relationships go? There's no need to hurry. Listening and talking are ways to show people that you really do see them as people. And of course, what if this woman's jabs at Jesus aren't really about Jesus at all? What if your friend's jabs at you or your neighbor's jabs at you aren't about you? What if this isn't the first time that this woman has felt teased by a Jew from Galilee or Judea? What if underneath that mockery in her replies, she's revealing her own hurt and sadness? If Jesus doesn't stick around, he's never going to find out, right? So he doesn't retreat. And instead, he says this, go, call your husband and come back. I have no husband, she replied. Jesus said to her, you are right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you have had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. What you have said is quite true. Sir, the woman said, I can see that you are a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. Woman, Jesus replied, believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in the Spirit and in truth, for they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is Spirit, and his worshipers must worship in the Spirit and in truth. And the woman said, I know that the Messiah is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us. And then Jesus declared, I, the one speaking to you, I am he. Jesus doesn't lecture, right? He invites, bring your husband here. And this gets a half-truth in reply. I have no husband. And then Jesus performs like the tiny miracle that we see in this story. That is that he reveals that he already knows this woman and he knows what's happened to her and how her life is going. He knows her life has been hard and uncertain. He knows that she's had a series of husbands, not because of infidelity, we should assume, because that would have ended one marriage, but then would have precluded any future ones. So the assumption is that it's because of death or possibly abuse or possibly a weak family support system, and that now she's living with a man who is providing for her, but in a way that is likely either transactional or an act of mere charity. And so it's such an interesting investment by Jesus here. He knows the woman's story already. Why does he banter? Why is it so easy when you read the first part of this story to imagine him smiling at her jabs at him? And I wonder if he waits, if he allows the conversation to play out the way it does, so that she can have a moment to feel strong in it. Did he do this in order to build trust? These are good questions, but I want us to notice a second pro tip here too, and it is this, that Jesus doesn't take political bait. You guys were hoping I wouldn't notice that or say that, and I wouldn't talk about that, but I'm going to. The conversation gets deeper, right? It gets under the surface. And the minute it gets under the surface, the woman does the same darn thing 2,000 years ago that we still do today, and that is she tries to pick a fight. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is Jerusalem. This is not what they have been talking about. Our ancestors, you Jews. Jesus might have proved by knowing her story that he's a prophet, but is he her prophet? Or is he just another champion for his own team? And again, Jesus meets the woman on her own terms. He does engage with her question, but instead of choosing the narrowness of a political side, he says something bigger. He says, believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. A time is coming when worship happens in the heart and not in a disputed place. Jesus doesn't hurry this conversation. Jesus avoids this us versus them trap of a political argument. And now that we've pushed through those first two layers, a real opening shows up in their conversation. Because she says the Messiah will explain all of this one day when he shows up. And I think in saying that, we should see that this woman is cautious, but she is finally willing to name the thing that she hopes for. I am he, Jesus says. And now, finally, we're really talking. What are we learning? What's the real hope that we have in Jesus? It's not just that we are securing an eternal future or finding all the right answers to our big questions about God and the universe. Our real hope, her hope, your hope, my hope, our real hope, our deepest hope, is that love really matters. It's that the spark we feel in ourselves in the moments when we are generous, or when we are kind, or when we forgive, or when we nurture somebody and care about somebody, that spark isn't as powerless in the world as it sometimes seems. That spark we feel is of God, and that it reflects God, and that God really is in control of all of this. That the world that we're in actually can be redeemed and restored. That there is ultimately reason to feel hope and embrace hope. And the woman in the story is guarded because she's scared. And here's the thing, right? We say this all the time. Being afraid is why we're always guarded. But what Jesus is offering her and what he's offering us isn't merely magic water so that you can live forever. I'm going to say it again because it's critically important to the story. He's not just offering magic eternal life water. If nothing changes in our lives and world right now, is magic forever living water even something you really want? He's offering her living water that nourishes and refreshes and restores life now. Not the legalism and self-righteousness of this temple on Mount Gerizim or the temple in Jerusalem, but a God who lives inside you and begins to bring you life today. In the next verses, the disciples come back, and when they do, John notes that they don't interrupt this conversation that they walk up on, right? They let it play out. And then the woman goes back to the town, and I love this detail. She goes back to the town still noncommittal. But she says to her neighbors, come see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Messiah? And while she's gone, Jesus tells his disciples, I tell you, open your eyes and look at the fields. They are ripe for harvest. Even now, the one who reaps draws a wage and harvests a crop for eternal life, so that the sower and the reaper may be glad together. And if you read on in the story, you'll see that the townspeople come out to the well and that Jesus is still right there, right where the woman left him. And in fact, that Jesus stays for two more days here. And John writes that over those 2 days, many of the Samaritans come to believe Jesus really is the Savior of the world. So what is the power of an unhurried conversation? It can show somebody that you see them the same way that Jesus sees them. When you don't rush, when you avoid us versus them traps, when you offer genuine compassion, and when you stick around afterwards, amazing things can happen. And it matters because people need to believe all of this is real. They need to see that that living water being offered to them isn't just about some future, but that it's something that can actually make things different right now. And you are the example of that. You are the evidence that a life spent trusting Jesus might end up one day in heaven for eternity, but that the hope of it can start and make a difference now. Freedom from fear and distrust and worrying constantly about whatever is around the next corner, that freedom is right here. I love that Jesus stays 2 days in this village. We know from the way the story's been going that he's got places to be, but those things can wait because the opportunity to transform these people's lives right now is what's right in front of him, and that's simply more important to him than his calendar. Go back for a moment to what he tells the disciples. Open your eyes and look at the fields. They are ripe for harvest. Don't be so mission focused that you do not see the mission field you are standing in. The issue isn't that people aren't ready to trust Jesus. That was true then, and it is still so true. The issue is not that people are not ready to trust Jesus. The issue is that we don't see them. Why do the disciples want to rush through Samaria at the beginning of the story? It's because it's where their political enemies live. Those people are too stubborn. Those people are too indoctrinated. They're too stupid even to see the truth, even if you were to put it right in front of their face. Do you hear how much this sounds like the moment we are living in right now? Factions and divisions make us utterly blind to each other. They make us so quick to give up on people and to forget that those people who are enemies are acting out of their own fears. Pick any political topic right now that is terrifying to you. Trade wars, executive orders, immigration, rolling back civil rights protections, egg prices, wokeness, MAGA, whatever. Your opponent is afraid. And whoever their political champion is, that champion is getting rich by telling those people who are scared that they are right to be scared, that the other side really is out to get them, and that if they just offer up their trust, this champion will win on their behalf. Mount Gerizim, Jerusalem, the only way to prove you're right is to destroy the people who think that you are wrong. How does Jesus care? What does Jesus do? He listens, and he banters, and he laughs, and he learns his so-called enemy's story, and he has compassion, and he exposes that us versus them conflict, that us versus them conflict is just a fight literally about who gets to control water that he knows never actually has to even run dry. The answer to these tensions is abundance of time, of grace, and of real love and life. Jesus tells us that kind of stuff. What if you believed him? What if you and I met fear with patience? What if we answered jabs with kindness? Like, what if we really lived our lives with confidence that love isn't a weak thing in a cruel world, but is in fact a living and abundant and holy thing that is infinitely supplied? I don't know how much more emphatically I can say this. People need to believe that this is real. And that means that it should feel crazy in a world that is so dedicated to fear and power. Last week, I learned that Evangeline, my oldest daughter, was studying the surrealism movement in her theater class. I was very excited about this. If you haven't met me or heard my story before, I was an English teacher for a long time. I love all the isms. I love teaching all the isms, and I love surrealism in particular. And for this assignment, for studying it, she had to watch a short film, which is why she let me know. Normally, she wouldn't tell me anything that she's learning, but she was stuck because she needed Dad to say, like, what is a surrealist short film I can watch? I need to find one. And I was like, oh, I've got 10. Let's go. She needed to watch this, and so I got to watch it with her, and it was a shot of, like, pure nostalgia for my teaching days. And it also meant that there was an opening for me to give, like, she'll give me, like, 5 minutes. I got to do, like, the 5-minute version of my old lecture, right? And I told her that the thing to know about surrealism as a movement is that it emerges in response to the horrors of World War I specifically, which was the first mechanized war. And all the inventions and the technologies that for a century through the Industrial Revolution, everybody had thought were going to turn the globe into a utopia where nobody had to work all day anymore and all of our jobs could be done for us by machines. All of that technology would turn things into a utopia. But then in World War I, of course, it ends up causing unimaginable slaughter at a scale never before seen on the planet. And as some artists in the 1920s wandered around the ruins of what used to be Europe, it occurred to them, What if cleverness isn't the answer we thought it was? If this is what all of our reason and logic lead us to, maybe we have been betting on the wrong horse. So they began to make art that resisted making any sense at all, that chose disorder and chaos and confusion over the things that led to slaughter. Now, your mileage may vary about how successful any surrealist art is, but the instinct of it, I think, is fascinating. We know already where the logic of this world leads. We know that social media divides us and that politics enrages us. And we know that having an abundance of money doesn't actually make us generous, it makes us greedy. We know how the world is. Do we really believe that the kind of living water Jesus is offering will make any sense at all here? What if it's supposed to sound crazy? Turning the other cheek, giving your last coat to the poor, loving a prisoner, someone already convicted of doing something bad, and praying for your enemies. These are ways of living out truly revolutionary and weird values in this world. And pausing what you are doing to simply have unhurried conversations with people is where all of those ways of living began. They are a choice to trust living water over whatever it is you think you can trap in a bucket. And they prove that love really can calm our fears and transform our lives now. So may we be so revolutionary as all that.